following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right. Welcome to a Monday. We love Mondays around here, don't we? All right. No, not really. But the good news is, at least there was some progress made over the weekend. Yeah. So the Senate got past the filibuster for the so-called bipartisan infrastructure deal. It is indeed infrastructure week again, but this time might actually be true. So it's looking like the so-called bipartisan bill will get through the Senate, and they could vote on it as soon as like very late tonight. So that could happen. Now, the thing is, too, this is a very multifaceted event here because, there's the other part of the bill, the other infrastructure, so to speak, the soft infrastructure, as some are calling it, the $3.5 trillion over 10 years bill to get America back on its feet again, as others may refer to it. And Nancy Pelosi is saying, don't bother sending me one without the other, because we, the House, will get through them at the same time. And a lot of things I criticize Nancy Pelosi for, this one I commend her for, because that's the way this was designed. And if we want to have nice things again, we need both of these packages to pass. If they just pass I hate calling it a bipartisan bill because it really isn't. Although, to get through cloture last night, every Democrat and those who caucused with the Democrats, Bernie Sanders and Angus King, voted for it, as did 19 Republicans. Now, neither of the two senators from down here in Florida did, but 19 did. So that's a big deal. And they should have the final vote, again, either tonight or tomorrow. There's some new senator from Tennessee who's holding things up because he's got Trump in his ear. I don't know. So we'll see what happens on the second one. But good on Chuck Schumer for keeping his caucus there, or keeping the Senate in session until they get this done. So that's the story on that. The other big news that we awoke to this morning was on climate change. Oh my God. The UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released what can only be described as a very dire report today, warning that the world is already locked into more weather-related disasters, higher and more acidic oceans, and other significant changes to the planet due to greenhouse gas emissions that we, you and I, humans, have put into the atmosphere for the last century and a half or so. And here's the thing. This is the first time that it's 234 climate scientists who participated in this report. They laid out five different scenarios. In all of them, the world fails in the ambitious climate target set in the 2015 Paris Agreement. We fail on every front. And what the goal was, to keep the planet less than 1.5 degrees Celsius warmer than the pre-industrial times. And I think we're already past that. Or we're close to it, actually, is what it is. We're close to it. This is not good. And hopefully, I'm working on a guest for tomorrow to get a little deeper into it to find out what exactly it says. But this goes back to the conversation we had last week with the climate guy. He's the one who wrote the book. It was like a letter to his future child. And we had the discussion, should anybody even be bringing new life into this world? I certainly wouldn't if I was still, a childbearing woman. I wouldn't. And again, I'm a mother through adoption, and it's a perfectly viable alternative than giving birth. There are millions of kids, ranging from newborns to older kids, who need homes, You want to build a family? Take in one who needs a loving family. Don't bring another human into this already overpopulated world where the planet is literally burning. Did you see Greece? Greece is on fire. And this is only going to keep getting worse. So, it's just not good. I'm sorry. I said it was 19 Republicans who joined him before. It's 18. I don't like to be wrong, so I'm correcting myself. Other stuff going on. Oh, my goodness. I'm here in Florida. Florida. We are the COVID capital of the world, and yet we have this governor who, you know, I get that he wants to be Donald Trump when he grows up. But come on, people. Get your heads out of your asses. Why anybody is touting him as the next, you know, presidential contender? I guess he couldn't possibly be worse than Trump. Actually, he could, because he's got the same Trump-idity, like stupidity. But he has an education. Go figure. He's, I think, Yale and Harvard educated. It's hard to tell when you listen to him. But wow. So more on death sentence is still out there. Even with the new data we've gotten over the last, you know, couple of weeks that shows Florida's numbers just exploding exponentially. Our hospitals are at capacity or overflowing. Everything. There are no beds available. I live in Broward County, which is the bluest county in all of Florida, and we are overflowing. Our hospitals are overflowing. Visitors can no longer go see their family members. If you are dying of COVID, you will die alone in Florida. All elective surgeries have been canceled. We are back to square one, or even worse, because the rate is shooting up like in a straight line if you look at the graphs. So when I hear people still touting this guy as the next best thing, I have to wonder what they're smoking and ask if I can have some, please. This is crazy. This is just crazy shit. So death sentence had issued a directive against mandates. No schools can declare a mask mandate, or I will take their funding away. First of all, he may be governor, but the last I checked, he wasn't king. We don't have a king. I don't think even the governor has unilateral powers to decide whether or not we're going to fund our public schools. Although he'll try, and our Florida Democratic Party is so anemic that they're not doing anything but issuing press releases and say, Manny Diaz, Democratic Party head is, you know, I don't know. It's just all sniping back and forth, and they're all horrible, and nobody's doing anything. So at least first down here where I am in Broward County, the school board said, yeah, he may have said no mask mandates allowed, but, you know, these are our kids and we're going to protect them. So fuck you, governor. We have a mask mandate. Then Miami-Dade County said, you know what? The first 2 weeks we will have masks and then we'll see how it goes from there. Hillsborough County, Tampa Bay area, just instituted a mask mandate. And it was last night or this morning, came down word from Palm Beach County. They, too, are putting a mask mandate in effect. And Governor Moron Death Sentence still pushes his insanity, I guess because he can. So if you haven't heard him speak much, this is Moron Death Sentence.
Great to be with Alec. Did you not get the CDC's memo? I don't see you guys complying.
Whoops, hold on. It's not playing. Give me a second.
And I say that jokingly, but I think that may be a sign of potentially seeking to do more
things in the future.
And I think it's very important that we say unequivocally, no closures, no to restrictions, and no mandates.
Screw you. Really? He's just insufferable.
Floridians are free to choose, and all Americans should be free to choose how they govern their affairs, how they take care of themselves and our families.
Yeah.
And they should not be consigned to live, regardless of which state in the union, consigned to live in a Faucian dystopia.
What?
In which we're governed by the whims of bureaucratic authorities who care little for our freedom, little for our aspirations, and little for our happiness. No more.
Oh my God.
We can't let it happen going forward.
Okay. No more stupidity going forward. Why is that piece of crap our governor? Can I just say, I'd rather have New Jersey's governor. And no, it's not Chris Christie anymore. You notice how Chris Christie is gone. You don't have a blowhard, loudmouth asshole in office anymore, so we never hear about him. But New Jersey's current governor is a guy named Phil Murphy. You want to see how Phil Murphy responded to a bunch of anti-vaxxers? This is classic. I want Phil Murphy for governor.
Please get vaccinated. Period.
Hello.
These folks back there have lost their mind. You've lost your minds. You are the ultimate knuckleheads, and because of what you are saying and standing for, people are losing their life.
Yep.
People are losing their life, and you have to know that. Look in the mirror.
Yeah. Look in the mirror.
Look in the mirror.
They have no reflections. They're all vampires. Yeah. So that's, oh, whoops. Oh, that's Phil Murphy, the governor of New Jersey, just to show you a contrast that there are governors out there who care about protecting their people. I don't know what Ron death sentence's thing is. I guess his kids are too young for school, so he doesn't have to worry about it. This is nonsense. People are dying. I got to play for you this one clip. Dr. Jonathan, I think it's Reiner, I'm probably getting his name wrong, is a CNN medical expert. Let me play for you this clip. Oh, shoot, this is not the edited one. Oh, well, it's okay. It's under 2 minutes, and you need to hear this. So this was on CNN. What?
Death sentence has 3 kids.
He has 3 kids.
Two of them.
Attend private schools. Oh, really? Okay, so David just told me 2 of death sentence's 3 kids are school age. They go to private schools that have mask mandates. Go figure. His little one, the youngest one, is too young. Okay, so here is this is Dr. Jonathan Reiner, and here we go.
Don't get your medical advice from the governor of Florida.
Hello.
First of all, there's no 1918 flu.
Yeah, he said there was.
Around. There are a number of tools that a chief executive has. So a chief executive can allow localities to mask up their population. They can certainly allow school districts to mask up kids who, first of all, many of whom cannot be vaccinated now, and protect them. He has prevented that. A chief executive of a state can allow vaccine mandates from businesses. He is preventing that.
Yep.
A chief executive can encourage businesses to shut down when the viral load is overwhelming.
Hello.
The viral load in Florida is so high right now.
Listen to this.
There are only really 2 places on the planet where it's higher. One is Louisiana, and the other is Botswana.
Botswana.
It's so high in Florida that I think that if Florida were another country, we would have to consider banning travel from Florida to the United States.
You hear
this? He needs to understand that he's painted himself into a corner. People are dying in Florida. It's going to get much worse.
Yep.
The hospitals are filling
children
with people
as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Children
leads
as well.
The country in
listen
the number
to
of hospitalized children.
Children. Children.
He has to back off a little bit, allow localities to do the right thing, to mask up, to even close businesses down. I've said this before. If you are in Florida now and you are unvaccinated, you are very likely going to get COVID. If you are in Florida and you are unvaccinated, do not go in to a bar or a restaurant. You will absolutely contract this virus.
If you are in Florida and are unvaccinated, do not go into a bar or a restaurant. You will contract COVID. Unequivocally. That's how bad it is down here. I'm back in the house. I'm not going out again. And when I do, I have my N95 mask because this time it's, well, it was real before. It's even more real now. I don't know what his end game is. I don't know what he thinks he's going to accomplish with this. Oh, man. But this is, you know, the other ongoing story that we cannot ignore. This is what's going on in our world. And we also have that little problem, you know, the future of our democracy. Yeah. Between the events around January 6th and now the news we're hearing from the former acting attorney general. So I have to get all the titles right. Jeff Rosen, because there was another Jeffrey Clark who should be in jail. But Jeffrey Rosen testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee last week. It wasn't the January 6th Commission, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the Justice Department. It was the Senate Judiciary Committee, just to get it all straight. Anyway, one person that I know that I can read about all this stuff is from Marcy Wheeler. Marcy Wheeler, of course, covers it all at emptywheel.net. She is based in the UK, actually in Ireland, sorry, not the UK, but that's where she's living these days. And I get more, better information from her Twitter feed at emptywheel and the website emptywheel.net than I get from most American journalists. So today I thought, let's go to Marcy Wheeler, check in with her, and see how it's all coming along, right? From what we learned about the Justice Department last week to the prosecution of these 500 plus people who are arrested at the Capitol. We're hearing some of them are being sentenced, though the sentences are not very, very long. They're not, you know, really prohibitive. So let's find out what's going on. So to do that, let's get Marcy Wheeler on the line. All right. So the magic of digital stuff. Let's head out to Ireland. Okay.
Normal might be overstating it, but that's fine.
Okay. So Marcy Wheeler is with us. Your blog is just, I think it's imperative reading for anybody who wants to stay up to date, especially on what's happening with the prosecutions around January 6th, because you've been all over that. Are they streaming those proceedings anywhere? How are you covering them?
In fact, your listeners can call in. There's a list of phone numbers for each of the judges on the DC court website. And you can see each daily calendar with the lists of the defendants. So, you know, if you're following a case that you're really interested in, you can actually go in and call in. You can't record every one of these hearings. They state very clearly that if you record the hearing, you're going to get in deep trouble. But thus far, the pandemic has worked in my favor, meaning that I can cover these prosecutions from here in Ireland.
I see. I was wondering how you had all the info, because I'm not seeing it really, these individual cases covered anywhere. So let's start with that, because this is important. There have been over 400 arrests in connection with January 6th. Do you know how many have been prosecuted so far?
There have been over 550 arrests.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Over 560, actually.
Wow. And
there have been, I'm going to say, roughly 20, 25 guilty pleas, of which four are cooperation pleas. Five are cooperation pleas. And the rest, with one exception, are misdemeanors. So people who were just MAGA tourists who, in general, are pleading guilty to parading or misdemeanor that can only carry a 6-month sentence. They are, you know, being asked to sit down with the FBI to go over their social media and what happened that day. And then the government is calling, or in one case last week, called for jail time for one defendant, last name Reeder. So they're not all going to get off with probation. There was a couple last week where the guy got sentenced to 1 month of home confinement, and the wife got sentenced to 2 months of home confinement because she was celebrating the insurrection afterwards. So even though these are misdemeanors, they're getting more punishment, or they may get more punishment than I think a lot of observers originally thought might happen.
Have any of the more high profile cases come up yet? You know, people that we saw during the photos in the original, coverage of the insurrection?
So there was a guy in the original photos who kind of rappelled down from the Senate gallery onto the floor of the Senate, if you
right.
recall that guy. He did plead guilty in a cooperation agreement. So he came to the insurrection with two other guys, Ronnie Sandlin and Nate DeGrave. They came armed. His name is Josiah Colt, and he brought a Glock to D.C., but not to the insurrection. He brought a Glock to the January 5 rally the night before. But the two other guys, Sandlin and DeGrave, were involved in two key assaults with cops. First at the East Door, where a bunch of people wrestled to get the East Door open, which led to basically a second front on the attack of the Capitol. And then to open the door of the Senate gallery, there was some pushing and shoving with cops there, which led the three of them and people like Joe Biggs and, other more, that's where one of the first breaches of the Senate gallery came in. Colt will cooperate against the other two, the two people that he came to insurrection with. The other four cooperation agreements are all members of the Oath Keepers. And in hearings in recent weeks, I would say at least five, maybe six different Proud Boys that are charged in conspiracies are talking about taking plea deals, and those plea deals would presumably require cooperation against their co-conspirators. I would be unsurprised if about three or four other Proud Boys also took plea deals. Again, they might be asked to cooperate against other Proud Boys. So we're talking still 2 months in the future that prosecutors are giving them this amount of time to consider these plea deals, because they're not that generous of plea deals. I mean, so for example, Colt, the guy I mentioned, was not charged with bringing a weapon into DC. John Schaefer, who's a rock musician who's tied to the Oath Keepers, he wasn't charged with assault, which in his case would have mattered a lot, because he probably wouldn't have been able to tour in Europe anymore.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And that's where his fan base is. But they're still charged with the obstruction charge that could carry a 20-year sentence. And in the case of the Oath Keepers, they're being charged with threats of violence. So they're being charged with significant jail time. I mean, they have the opportunity to cooperate their way out of it. The most interesting aspect is one of the Oath Keepers who has pled is this guy, Graydon Young, from Florida. And in his plea, he got out of the charge against the Oath Keepers that carries a terrorism enhancement. So in other words, he won't be treated as a terrorist when it comes to his sentencing, but he is testifying against his sister, who he invited to come to the insurrection. Her name's Laura Steele. And so it's a remarkable choice, because she's one of the people that his cooperation is going to implicate.
Wow. So none of the cases where people have cooperated and said this person was in on the planning, and, you know, the more ringleader-like people have not been tried yet.
No, and they won't be. Those trials won't start until next year at the earliest. I mean, there are a couple people. One is a 3%er by the name Guy Reffitt from Texas. He's the one who threatened his son and daughter if they told the cops about him.
Oh my God.
He is pushing for trial this year. And Robert Gieswine, who is one of the people who went in the Capitol again, that you see in pictures, who went in with a baseball bat and a helmet, that guy is trying to go to trial this year as well. It's not clear that's going to happen.
I see. So you've got so many posts at emptywheel.net dealing with these hearings that are coming up. Are they full-fledged trials, or are they shorter hearings, or how are these running?
We're still at hearings. So,
okay.
you know, uh, when you're being prosecuted, the generally the judge schedules a meeting every month or every 2 months just to make sure that things are moving along, to make sure that the discovery is happening, to find out whether prosecutors have offered plea agreements to basically troubleshoot, to make sure nothing's going awry with the prosecution. And so that's where we're getting updates on prosecutions there and in detention hearings. There are still people being arrested, and those people, some of them are dangerous enough that the government is trying to get them detained. And detention hearings are where we have in the past seen some of the evidence that prosecutors are looking at, either the video evidence. That's how a media consortium got those videos of some of the assaults that happened outside of the Capitol. That's why they were able to get those released. But also things like the texts that the Proud Boys used to organize that day, those all came out as part of detention hearings that 4, 5, 6, 7 different Proud Boys are detained and trying to get out. Actually, more than that, but seven were central enough to the main attack on the Capitol that we're learning about the attack that through their detention hearings.
Got it. So the only sentencing we've heard so far are people who've pled guilty and are
correct. Yeah.
Okay.
So who've pled guilty as a straight up guilty plea.
Gotcha.
So again, there was one guilty plea on the obstruction charge that a lot of people are being charged with, and the rest are all misdemeanors. And most of the, I mean, and of the misdemeanors, we've only seen 5 sentences. The rest will start in earnest in September. We also, on Friday, there were 2 people who pled guilty to assault.
Uh-huh.
The more interesting of those is a guy named Scott Fairlamb, who punched a cop. He went in the Capitol close to Dominic Pizzola, then came back out and punched a cop in the helmet. And he was charged with a bunch of things. He pled guilty to assault and to obstruction, to that same obstruction charge the people are pleading guilty to. And in the sentencing hearing, the prosecutor, her name is Leslie Gomat, as the sides were describing to the judge what the terms of the agreement were, she made a point of saying, look, we've reserved the right to come back to you next month. This guy's being sentenced on September 27th.
Yes.
We reserve the right to come back to you and say, we want a terrorism enhancement for this dude.
Wow.
And so even though he wasn't charged with one of the crimes that carries a terrorism enhancement, that's been used with all of the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers. The government has at least left open the possibility that they're going to come back and say, look, this guy pled guilty to intending to stall the vote, and this guy pled guilty to punching a cop. And those 2 things together equate to terrorism. So we may actually see that happen as soon as next month in that case. And I know that there are other defendants that are reluctant to sign these plea deals, because the government is keeping that terrorism enhancement language in the plea deals, is reserving the ability to come back and say, look, this was terrorism.
Good. I mean, I hope they do invoke it. You have a piece, an article up at emptywheel.net on this very story. Scott Fairlamb pled guilty to obstruction and assault. Does that amount to terrorism? So this is all just not even really started to unfold yet. This is all still to come. Is this normal to how it's taking so long?
There are things that are holding up things like misdemeanors. And I'd say 3 main things. One is COVID, of course, continues to slow everything that goes through the courts up. 2 is that discovery in this is just an unbelievable undertaking. And one of the reasons is that even just the video evidence that law enforcement had in their possession on January 6th means you have to go collect the body-worn cameras from all the MPD cops.
Mm-hmm.
The Capitol cops, by the way, don't have or did not have body-worn cameras.
Really?
And then you have to go get the CCTV from inside the Capitol. You have to get location data from inside the Capitol. But in addition, some of the most important video, not least because the Capitol police officers didn't wear body-worn cameras, some of the most important video comes from other defendants.
Right.
So, for example, I've written a post about this. For example, that scene, which everyone has seen, where mobsters are trying to break into the speaker's lobby and one guy punches through all of the windows and then Ashley Babbitt right. jumps through one of the windows and she's shot. That scene, there were some MPD cops there, so there are some body-worn cameras that picked up that shot, and there is some CCTV, but some of the most important video of what happened, particularly because what people said is so important to understand their intent. But, you know, because what the main things that you could hear from the videos that are most widely circulated was everyone screaming, break it down, break it down, break it down. And I think there's even Ashley Babbitt caught in some of that video saying, you know, what the fuck? But, you know, it matters to how you charge each of these defendants, whether they were egging on each other or whether they were saying, don't engage in violence. And so for the four defendants that were right there at the front with Ashley Babbitt, all but one of whom, by the way, are charged with a crime that also can carry a terrorism enhancement. So it may be that what would have been her co-defendants had she survived will be called terrorists once it gets to the sentencing down the road. But some of the most important evidence against those guys comes from other defendants. I would say the majority of the misdemeanor defendants who are still being arrested, when you read their arrest affidavits, you see the FBI describing them being caught on CCTV wandering through the Capitol with their cell phone out, videotaping others.
Uh-huh.
And so, or carrying a GoPro in or something sure. like that. And so I've argued that most of the people being arrested for misdemeanors right now are being arrested to get to their cell phone contents, to get to their evidence on sure. other defendants. And when they are sentenced, they are one of the things that they're basically being asked to do in their statement of offense is validate that they did in fact take that video and that they did in fact share that video with the FBI. So when it's used in a trial against somebody who committed a more serious crime, mm-hmm. you know, then it will be brought in fairly easily as evidence. So that's one of the things that makes this so complex. The other, I got distracted, but the one other thing that is creating a longer timeline on the less serious crimes is that, contrary to what you might believe, prosecutors are asking and have the ability to ask people to plead guilty to a higher level of offense than they otherwise would. Just as an example, we hear this all the time. Right wingers say, well, you know, why weren't Portland trespassers of the courthouse treated the same way as these guys?
Right.
And in fact, a ton of Portland people were arrested. One of the issues in Portland is if it didn't happen in the federal courthouse, it's not clear that the U.S. government has jurisdiction. But one defendant tried that in a court filing, and the government came back and they said, well, you know, in Portland, it was dark and people weren't taking video of everything. Whereas here, we can capture the 1,000 people who trespassed inside the Capitol and eventually will come down and charge you, you know? So one of the things that differentiates it is that there is so much evidence. But the other thing is the DOJ is treating this rightly, I think, as a really extraordinary event. They're treating it very soberly as an attempt to overthrow the peaceful transfer of power.
Great. We're speaking with Marcy Wheeler, emptywheel.net. You can find her on Twitter at emptywheel, and you should follow her and read the blog because there's tons of information there. So you're covering these individual hearings, the individual cases. At the same time, the January 6th Select Committee in the House has begun their work. There's obviously things are feeding off of each other. You've got another piece up at Empty Wheel. Paul Gosar take actions on behalf of Donald Trump that contributed to Ashley Babbitt's death? In fact, you just posted that this morning. And so we're learning, I guess both are feeding off of each other. Is there cooperation between the prosecutors and the select committee at all?
Not that we know. I expect the select committee will track. Look, it is an overwhelming task to keep up with all of, again, 550 defendants. It takes a lot to do that. But there is, as a result of that, a lot there that that the January 6th Commission can refer to. They're looking for, they're pursuing suspects co-conspirators, if you will, who are harder for DOJ to get to. So for example, Trump. I mean, ultimately, DOJ can subpoena the White House for Trump's call records. You know, DOJ can ask Mark Meadows to sit for an interview. But as we saw in the Mueller investigation, DOJ is going to have some anxiety about the executive privilege covering discussions between Mark Meadows and Trump that day. Now, they did, and this is probably where you're going to go, they did say that the six people at DOJ that two different committees in Congress have asked to speak to about Trump's efforts to get DOJ to overturn the election, DOJ told those six people, one of whom is Jeffrey Rosen, who was the acting attorney general after Bill Barr quit in December, DOJ told them, executive privilege doesn't apply here. We've asked Joe Biden. He has waived it. And the reason it doesn't apply is because privilege is about protecting the republic, not protecting an individual. And so Jeffrey Rosen and another top DOJ official, Richard Donahue, late last week provided hours of testimony to Congress. And I wouldn't be surprised if FBI is not speaking to those people directly. I wouldn't be surprised if Congress shares those transcripts with the FBI. What happened with the Russian investigation is when particularly the Senate Intelligence Committee found evidence of a crime, they would share it with Mueller. Oh. And so you actually, for some key people, and Roger Stone, I mean, Roger Stone was prosecuted for lying to the House Intelligence Committee. That prosecution relied on getting that transcript from the House Intelligence Committee. So you could see that kind of synthesis back and forth. The other thing that the House committee, the January 6th committee, might do that would help DOJ get over some limits on their ability to prosecute is if they were to interview Paul Gosar or Kevin McCarthy or Jim Jordan, if they were to conduct that interview, it would be easier for DOJ to overcome the speech and debate protections that some members of Congress would otherwise have. Now, the other thing that happened a couple weeks ago is that Eric Swalwell is suing a bunch of people, including Mo Brooks. Right. And Mo Brooks tried to get DOJ to basically replace him. Yeah. And DOJ said, no, we're not going to do that because, and this was actually a really clever but also true argument, which is that you as a member of Congress cannot, in your official duty, campaign, whether it's for yourself or whether it's for the president. And what you were doing on January 6th was a campaign event for Donald Trump, and therefore you're not covered. Yeah, like you are not covered by speech and debate for those activities because they are not within your official duties. And in that filing, they also said, and oh, by the way, no federal employees are. DOJ's decision to substitute Trump in the E. Jean Carroll decision depended on Trump being an employee.
Right.
Like it was fairly controversial to say that Trump was an employee entitled to be replaced. But Bill Barr's DOJ has said Trump was an employee of the U.S. government.
Yes.
And therefore, when DOJ says an employee of the federal government can't do two things. One, they can't campaign as part of that role. When they campaign, they are not an employee of the federal government. And two, they can't attack their employer who happens to be the federal government. And so that, I think, was language that will pave the way if DOJ sees fit to go after Trump by
Absolutely.
Saying that he is not going to be protected as president because those were clearly campaign activities.
Wow, that's interesting. So, all right. So there's investigations going on in different venues. So you got the hearings, right? You got the select committee, and then you have the thing that brought Jeffrey Rosen to testify before the DOJ this week. It was closed testimony. We didn't get to see it, but many members did. That's not the select committee who did that. Hearing or that.
That hearing was the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Okay.
So Dick Durbin made a request for that testimony way back in January. One of the remarkable things is all of the things we have learned in recent days about Jeffrey Rosen and Trump's effort to get DOJ to overthrow the election, that was all reported by Katie Benner. New York Times' Katie Benner on January 22nd, before impeachment, before the impeachment vote, before the impeachment trial. And so, you know, a lot of people are going, wow, you know, this is crazy new testimony. I'm like, no, Katie Benner had it in January, but it's a testament to how you really need to have this apparatus in place to force or to enable. I mean, it sounds like Jeffrey Rosen has wanted to testify all this time. He just needed a way to get over Trump's claims of an executive privilege. And probably he knows, because he was involved in the late stages of the Mueller investigation, he knows that he needed to find a way to avoid executive privilege, barring the use of his testimony to prosecute those involved. Okay. So we'll see.
One of the things I love about your blog is often you ask the questions in the headline that I want to ask you anyway. Why did the DOJ delay 7 months before letting Jeffrey Rosen testify?
I don't know. You know, one possibility is they didn't have things in place to do so. One of the things they did before getting that testimony was set up what's called the contact policy. And the contact policy basically prohibits anybody from the White House from any kind of visibility into criminal prosecutions. That was put into place on July 21st. And then this letter that permitted Rosen to testify was sent out on July 27th or 28th. The Mo Brooks letter was sent in July 27th or 28th. And then, sometime between the contact policy, the new contact policy being established, and that letter coming out, sometime in that week, I think, DOJ, and actually a DOJ employee who Jeff Sessions promoted, so a DOJ employee who was a senior DOJ employee under Trump, a DOJ employee contacted the White House counsel and said, hey, can you talk to Joe Biden and ask him if he's willing to waive privilege? And so that detail from the letter is actually fairly important because it means that Joe Biden didn't have any contact with prosecutors. No prosecutor contacted the White House to make that request. And in fact, the waiver of privilege actually happened for something that doesn't involve prosecutorial function. And if it's possible, I mean, look, Jeffrey Rosen had 14 days when he could have decided to go testify to Congress on his own. He was in charge of this investigation. He was the guy absolutely in charge of this investigation for the first 14 days after the riot. And he did not, in those 14 days, choose to go testify. So there is a reason why DOJ delayed, and it goes beyond the desire to testify because Jeffrey Rosen claims he wanted to testify all this time and he didn't do it when he had the authority to order himself to go testify. And so my guess is it has to do with separation of power, and it has to do with setting up enough insulation in this investigation such that nobody can claim down the road that Joe Biden is attacking his predecessor. I mean, as I said, the DOJ official who contacted the White House is somebody that Jeff Sessions promoted, not Merrick Garland. And it's possible, and I don't know this to be a fact, but Merrick Garland has repeatedly, most recently, I think July 6th, but I think he's done it since then once. Merrick Garland has on numerous occasions, including his confirmation hearing, and including statements of support for DOJ investigators, he said, you know, we're going to take this investigation wherever the evidence leads. Mm-hmm. And it may be that sometime in July, DOJ got to a point in its evidence where they decided the evidence leads right to Donald Trump. Now, you asked me earlier about people who had cooperated. Mm-hmm. I mentioned Graydon Young. Yes. He's an Oath Keeper.
Right.
And he is from Florida. And so he was involved. It all comes back to Florida.
Always Florida. Florida.
You should brag about this.
Always Florida. Florida.
But he was involved, among other things, in protecting Roger Stone.
Uh-huh. Of course.
So in December, the people who would go on to lead a militia assault on the Capitol were hanging around with Roger Stone in Florida. And so if that guy cooperating was able to give some kind of insight into what kind of discussions were happening in Florida in December, that would be really valuable testimony, but it would also be one of the things that might directly implicate. I mean, there are two ways that you're going to get directly from the people who invaded the Capitol, at least two ways, but two that we know of, that you're going to get from people who invaded the Capitol to Donald Trump. And one is Roger Stone. Roger Stone was with the Oath Keepers who ran to the Capitol to be part of that invasion. He has ties to the Proud Boys going back years. And he was with Trump on key days in December. So Roger Stone is, we know that people who defended him are cooperating him. The other one is Rudy Giuliani. Oh, Rudy Giuliani, we know, had ties to the brother of a guy named John Sullivan, who, by the way, took that video of Ashley Babbitt's killing.
Oh, interesting.
It all comes back. Yes. But anyway, that guy's brother was in touch with Rudy Giuliani a week after the riot, talking about having helped some of his agent escape from the FBI or avoid justice with the FBI. And wow. So given that Rudy Giuliani had claimed to members of Congress that to know what the rioters were doing in real time. And so we don't know yet what Rudy Giuliani was doing, but we know that he did have ties with rioters. Now Trump had other roles on January 6th, one of which was to get members of Congress to delay long enough for the rioters to come and threaten Mike Pence and Nancy Pelosi personally. But the way to get there through the rioters, we're close. We don't know yet how close we are, in part because really valuable cooperators we may not know that they're cooperating. And so, DOJ may be keeping it under wraps.
Sure.
But that's how it could come back to Trump. I don't guarantee that it has. DOJ has laid some infrastructure to make it possible, but that's far from a guarantee that it's going to happen.
Right. Well, it seems, Marcy, that there are different, multi-pronged ways that they're going at him. One is over January 6th, but the other is the bigger the details we just learned last week, a lot from Jeffrey Rosen's testimony about Jeffrey Clark. So the sequence of the Department of Justice under Trump was, it was Jeff Sessions. Then he replaced Jeff Sessions with Bill Barr. And then at the end, when Bill Barr, I guess, wasn't doing his bidding enough, Trump replaced him with Jeffrey Rosen. And then what we learned is that he wanted to then replace Jeffrey Rosen with Jeffrey Clark, who wanted to go to each individual state, the ones that Trump, I guess, lost, to have them flip the votes. I mean, this is a whole other area separate from January 6th, but it's all interconnected. What we learned this week was pretty monumental, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, again, Katie Benner had most of this in January, but we know that we have witnesses providing the testimony, which is what's different in the last couple of days. It's, look, this operation started before the election, right? Trump told the Proud Boys on September 29th to stand back and stand by.
That's right.
This operation started when last summer Bill Barr was trying to turn Antifa into some kind of terrorist threat and therefore turn the Proud Boys into legitimate arms of law enforcement. But there are key moments in December, especially, where Trump was at the same time already advertising for the January 6th riot at the same time as he was still fostering the big lie and the attempt to, so Bill Barr quits on December 14th, Jeffrey Rosen takes over, and immediately, Jeffrey Clark says, here's a letter I've drafted. With the help of a member of Congress. Here's a letter I've drafted, not Florida, by the way. Uh-huh. That one's Pennsylvania. But here's a letter I've drafted. Can you send it to Georgia to tell them to rerun the election?
Wow.
And And Rosen and Donahue twice said no. Donahue was like, "There's no way I would send that letter. It conflicts with everything DOJ has discovered in their investigations of the election so far." And it all came to a head on January 3rd when Trump brought Rosen to the White House and said, "I'm thinking of replacing you with Clark," and it was very similar to what I call the hospital hero confrontation back in 2004 when Jim Comey and Jack Goldsmith and some others refused to reauthorize the warrantless wiretap program. It's very similar and in fact includes the same person. There was this guy named Pat Philbin who was Jim Comey's deputy back in 2004. And was one of the people who was going to resign in 2004. And he was involved in these emails back and forth from Pat Cipollone, sounded like he was going to resign as well if this went through. So all of these people, both in the White House and in DOJ, threatened to resign if Trump replaced Rosen with Clark. One of those people, though, had been there back in 2004, the last time this kind of confrontation with the president happened. And basically, the way Katie Benner reported it, again, this story that I encourage you all to go back and read, which was published on January 22nd, the way she reported it was not that Trump decided he couldn't get away with it legally. What he decided was that by replacing Rosen with Clark, he would distract too much from his efforts to interrupt the vote count. And that's important to know because, everyone today is saying, "Oh, Jeffrey Rosen is a hero for testifying." Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, that ignores a lot of things that Jeffrey Rosen did in 2020 to thwart ongoing investigations that were into people really close to Trump, including Rudy Giuliani. So Jeffrey Rosen is no hero, but he did testify. But the last time he testified with the Senate committee that was looking into the response, he sort of said, "We were not put in charge. We were not the lead agency in responding to January 6th violence." DOD says he was. DOD says that Donahue and Rosen, both of whom are testifying about Trump, they were the ones who should have called up DOD early and said, "Plans change. We need armed National Guard to go to the Capitol starting at 1 p.m. And DOD, their reasons for delaying 4 hours, 5 hours before they actually got the guard there, one of their main reasons for delaying is that no one at DOJ was doing that. No one at DOJ was saying, "We need to get the guard to protect the Capitol." Right. And so, and Trump asked them. Trump put Rosen in charge of that lead agency response on January 3rd. So one of the many important questions we need answered is, did that really happen? Did he really put Rosen in charge? And if so, why did Rosen and Donahue not respond more aggressively when it became clear that the Capitol was being overrun? But it bears remembering that the people who were supposed to be in charge of responding on January 6th were people who had been threatened with firing on January 3rd.
Wow. Wow. This is the most complex. It's like a maze and things interconnect with different tunnels. If you were to look at it visually, Marcy Wheeler, I could keep asking you questions. I know, but we have a time limit here. This whole thing, when you look at it as a whole and step back, the thing that comes to mind for me is how wholly unprepared this nation was and is to fight back domestic terrorism, to fight an insurrection where we spend trillions of dollars on the national, quote, defense. But it seems like when it comes to our domestic issues like this, we're just grossly unprepared.
DOJ and Homeland Security have done a number of things since January 6th to change this. The really important thing to remember, though, I mean, I already mentioned this, right? Like September 29th, Trump said to the Proud Boys, "Stand back and stand by."
Yes, he did.
And in January or February 2019, several Proud Boys were involved with Roger Stone, going back to Florida. These were all Floridians. Several Proud Boys were involved in crafting a threat against Amy Berman Jackson, the judge overseeing Roger Stone's trial. And when Stone was being sentenced in 2020, Bill Barr, his DOJ at a very high level said, we are not going to hold Roger Stone accountable for a violent threat against the judge presiding over his case because it was just a technicality. That's literally what, I mean, that like, that's not a direct quote from what they said, but that is legally what they, the argument they made. It's just not that big of a deal if you threaten a judge and put crosshairs on her. And so I think a bigger issue than us being prepared, because once we identify a threat, this government knows how to respond.
Okay.
The big issue is that under Bill Barr, the Proud Boys were treated as allies.
Right.
Rather than as domestic terrorists. And so, you know, we saw with the Russian investigation that it was a firing offense for anybody at FBI to investigate Trump's associates. Investigate Trump's associates, you will get fired.
Right.
That was the lesson of Peter Strzok. That was the lesson of Andrew McCabe. That was the lesson of Jim Comey. And so I think that there had to have been a tremendous reluctance to treat the Proud Boys as the terrorists they were and to do things. I mean, the government has all but said officially that even though four different Proud Boys claim that they were informants for the FBI, they were informants to the extent that they believed they were about Antifa. They were not informants about the Proud Boys. Uh-huh. So while it is true that one of these guys who by his own description had been an informant for the FBI about Antifa, while it is true that that guy has provided testimony and seems to be cooperating against the Proud Boys in that prosecution, he didn't show up to the insurrection only because he had to work that day and he had a new job. But that guy, you know, but that's different. Him being willing to cooperate with the FBI after a terrorist attack is different from FBI talking to him ahead and saying, you know, do you have a plan to pincer the Capitol? And do you have multiple channels of cooperation set up with these other militias? And what are the channels of cooperation with the White House? That's something FBI didn't do in advance. And they didn't do it in advance because I think, and this is my opinion, but they didn't do it in advance because everyone at FBI knew that investigating anyone having anything to do with the president was a firing offense. And so they didn't do it.
Unbelievable. It's just astounding how the Keystone Cop aspect of it all, just how, I don't know. Marcy Wheeler, one last question for you. Is, you know what, never mind, because I'm asking you to speculate. There's so much stuff here and there's so much more to come. So I urge everyone, read emptywheel.net. There's a wealth of information and it keeps coming. And this is going to go on for a while. There's no
forever
end in sight.
Yeah. Yes, oh, it is.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for sharing it all with us and for the work you're doing. It's so valuable. Again, I'm not seeing it anywhere else. So Marcy Wheeler, again, you come through. Thank you.
Always great to talk to you, Nicole.
Always good to talk to you, too. Appreciate it.
Take care of Florida. Do something about Florida.
I wish I could. You want Ron death sentence? Oh, my God. It's just,
all right.
It's nuts. All right. I'll talk to you soon. Thank you.
Stay safe.
All right.
Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye. Marcy Wheeler, she's just so full of information. And I literally could have kept going with her. Just I already kept her for probably 15 minutes longer than we had planned. So, you know, she's one of those guests like David Dayen, like one of my favorite guests ever. And I try not to impose on them too often because I don't want to wear out our welcome. I mean, this has been going on for, you know, more than a dozen years or so. And so for those in the chat rooms who asked, please make Marcy a regular. Well, she is, kind of, just not every week. But I do try to have her on about once a month. But I'm telling you, bookmark emptywheel.net because she is on top of it. And what's so astounding is she's living in Ireland these days and covers what's happening here better than, well, almost anyone else. And with that, we come to the end of another action-packed episode of The Nicole Sandler Show. This is one of those weeks. I'm not quite sure what we're doing tomorrow yet. It's Tuesday. It's Laffy's off week. And I'm trying to get someone on the UN climate report because that was pretty devastating. So I've got a bunch of stuff in the works. We'll see what happens, what comes of age tomorrow. We'll find out. In the meantime, check out my lovely artwork. There's a beautiful little yellow lab puppy in the back. That's a new one. I do pet portraits. If anyone's interested, just write to me. And here every day, 5 Eastern, 2 Pacific, on the Progressive Voices Network and on your YouTube and Twitter and Twitch and Facebook. All right. I'll see you tomorrow, everyone. Thank you for listening. Bye. All right. I said goodbye to the people listening on Progressive Voices. I think they're done there. And I, as I tend to do as the show ends, I will leave you with today's episode of What's News. Oh, but I hold on. What, there's sound coming out of here, and I need to make sure it's all turned down. There we go. All right, now for today's news. See you tomorrow, everyone. I read the news
today, oh boy. It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Code Red for Humanity. That's the gist of the new climate assessment the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released on Monday, warning that the world was already locked into more weather-related disasters, higher and more acidic oceans, and other significant changes to the planet due to greenhouse gas emissions humans have put into the atmosphere since the 1850s. The 234 climate scientists laid out 5 different scenarios. Their conclusion is that the world fails the most ambitious climate target set in the 2015 Paris Agreement, keeping the world less than 1.5 degrees Celsius warmer than pre-industrial times. Though the scientists said that the most dire scenario, doing nothing, is less likely than before. Seriously. Unlike previous assessments, the report also concludes that it is unequivocal that humans have caused the climate crisis. The report states that the world has rapidly warmed 1.1 degrees higher than the pre-industrial levels and is now careening towards 1.5 degrees. Scientists say the only way to keep from reaching this point of no return and to prevent more catastrophic damage is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to zero. We're not even in the ballpark. Moving on to infrastructure. In a 68-29 vote, the Senate ended debate on the so-called bipartisan infrastructure bill that spends $550 billion in new money on the nation's physical infrastructure. Sunday's vote came after senators spent the week haggling over amendments and time agreements to consider them. Final passage of the bill is expected late Monday night or very early Tuesday morning at the latest. If it passes, it moves to the House, where its outcome is less certain. Speaker Pelosi has already said she would not take up this bill until the Senate also passes the larger package. And first thing Monday morning, Senate Democrats unveiled it, the blueprint for that $3.5 trillion budget resolution that they plan to pass through the reconciliation process that won't require any Republican votes. But now we learn that the package does not include any increase to the debt ceiling. Despite the Democrats working with the Republicans to increase the debt ceiling at least 3 times during Trump's 4 years in office, the Republicans now are saying they won't do the same. Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has warned that they will not give Democrats the votes they need to ensure that the U.S. wouldn't default on our debts that have already been allocated by Congress. Just lovely. Moving on to COVID. Oh, man. The average number of new coronavirus cases in the U.S. increased 9 times since the beginning of July, and hospitalizations are at their highest rate since February. In some parts of the country, hospitals are at or over capacity, and there's once again a shortage of life-saving equipment. And as if the situation isn't bad enough, new concerns are popping up. Dr. Fauci says the continued spread of the virus could allow new variants, possibly ones more resistant to vaccines, to emerge and spread if more people don't get vaccinated. But finally, the rest of the country is seeing what we here in Florida already knew. The governor hasn't got a clue.
You have some politicians that say, I am going to eliminate the virus. I will defeat it. Unfortunately, government can't just end it. We still have 1918 flu floating around. So it's something that, if government could just end it, then people wouldn't even need to get the treatment or because you could just end it, right? You can't. So we knew this is something that's going to that you're going to have to live with.
Dr. Jonathan Reiner is a CNN medical analyst. He had a few words to share about not Dr. Ron DeSantis.
Don't get your medical advice from the governor of Florida. First of all, there's no 1918 flu floating around. There are a number of tools that a chief executive has. So a chief executive can allow localities to mask up their population. They can certainly allow school districts to mask up kids who, first of all, many of whom cannot be vaccinated now, and protect them. He has prevented that. A chief executive of a state can allow vaccine mandates from businesses. He is preventing that. A chief executive can encourage businesses to shut down when the viral load is overwhelming. The viral load in Florida is so high right now. There are only really two places on the planet where it's higher. One is Louisiana, and the other is Botswana. It's so high in Florida that I think that if Florida were another country, we would have to consider banning travel from Florida to the United States. If you are in Florida now and you are unvaccinated, you are very likely going to get COVID. If you are in Florida and you are unvaccinated, do not go in to a bar or a restaurant. You will absolutely contract this virus.
But good news, I suppose, for Americans wanting into Canada. Canada on Monday lifting its ban on Americans crossing its border for non-essential travel for the first time since March of 2020. Yeah, the U.S. is not reciprocating yet, keeping its northern and southern borders closed until at least August 21st. So Americans who want to travel to Canada will have to be fully vaccinated, test negative for COVID-19 within 3 days of travel, and fill out a detailed application online. The Canada Border Services Agency didn't estimate how many U.S. residents it expects to cross the border, but it did suggest that travelers might face lines at those border crossings. Now, if you're planning to cruise out of Florida, well, you might be a little safer today. A federal judge in Miami granted Norwegian Cruise Lines a preliminary injunction Sunday night, at least temporarily blocking a Florida law that bans private companies from requiring proof of COVID vaccinations. U.S. District Judge Kathleen Williams wrote in her ruling that Florida, quote, fails to provide a valid evidentiary, factual, or legal predicate for its vaccine passport ban, end quote. Governor Ron DeSantis first issued an executive order banning companies from requiring proof of vaccination. Then he signed a law passed by the legislature that would fine cruise ships that required vaccination proof up to $5,000 per passenger. Under this ruling, the Norwegian Gem can now set sail from Miami on August 15th, with only passengers and crew who can prove that they have been vaccinated. Things here in Florida are not good. On CNN, medical analyst Dr. Jonathan Reiner held nothing back regarding Florida and our governor, who some of us lovingly refer to as Governor Death Sentence. And if you're planning to go to New Orleans for the rescheduled Jazz and Heritage Festival, get a refund. The festival, which was rescheduled for the fall of 2021, has again been canceled, citing rising COVID cases. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is fully listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.